Coming up next, we partner with the SAFE Coalition to celebrate the month of September, which is National Recovery Month. In studio today, we have two guests who will share with us stories of hope and healing from our nation's number one health epidemic, substance use disorder. So stay tuned for courageous stories of real hope, coming up next on Chapters. My name's Jim Derrick, and welcome to another edition of Chapters. On today's program, we celebrate National Recovery Month with the SAFE Coalition. The SAFE Coalition is made up of a group of community volunteers which have stepped forward to fight our nation's number one health epidemic, the disease of substance use disorder. Sadly, this year alone, we expect to lose over 72,000 people in the United States of America to drug overdoses. And oftentimes, we find that the news media and the coverage focuses on that tragedy. But happily, there are real stories of recovery happening right here in our community. And we wanted to highlight a couple of those today. And we're extremely appreciative of our two guests that courageously stepped forward to share their stories so that we can learn from their experience and also experience the hope that recovery is possible. So here's our first guest, Mandy Lerner. I'm joined in studio by my guest, Mandy Lerner. Welcome, Mandy.
Hi, Jim.
September is National Recovery Month, and the SAFE Coalition is featuring a recovery story every day on our Facebook site. And all of those recovery stories have been gathered so far from nationally submitted stories, so we have a lot of wonderful stories up there. However, nothing's more powerful than having you sitting in the studio here to share your recovery story, which happened right here in town. And I can't tell you how happy I am to have you here. So, Mandy, you grew up in Franklin.
I did. I spent my younger years in Franklin. I was here first grade through fifth grade.
Yep.
Went to the Franklin Public Schools. During fifth grade, my parents separated, mm-hmm. so I was transferred to the Cape. My mm-hmm. mother and I moved to the Cape.
Yep.
But I ended up back in Franklin at the end of high school.
At the end of high school. And at that point, by the end of high school, you had... you understood, or at least you understand now, that you were an addict and alcoholic from a very, very young age.
I do understand now.
Yeah.
At that point, I absolutely did not.
Right.
I was having fun. That was what I thought. That was my excuse. My reason for everything was I'm just a teenager having fun.
Sure. And how old were you, Mandy, when you started using substances?
I experimented around 11 or 12, and it really took off. Mm-hmm. Closer to 13 or 14.
Yeah. An important part of your story, though, is also that there were other things going on in your life, and you just mentioned a couple. So you're young and you're relocated. To the adult, mm-hmm. that's not a big deal, but to a young person, that's traumatic, right? You've got to make
Absolutely.
New friends. You've got a new school, new teachers, right?
You're the new girl. Everybody knows who you are. You don't know who anybody is. And, you know, I always felt a little left out or alone because all these kids had been here most of their lives, so they all had friends
right.
and their group of friends, and I was just alone trying to fit in, and that was definitely very hard for me. And it's an awkward age, so it was just really hard to be the new girl at that time.
In the middle of all this, you have the obsession over self-medicating with alcohol and drugs, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
So a lot of people ask whether this is something that's a choice. And to that, you would say what?
Absolutely not. Mm. It's not a choice. This is something that you're born with. It starts at a young age. It's a behavior, and it's a disease of the mind. Mm. It's 100% something that you don't have control over unless you can treat it.
Right. And I really appreciate you bringing that up. And it's so important that we hear that message, because parents like me, so often we want to blame, number one, ourselves. What did mm-hmm. we do wrong? What is it I missed? You know, and especially when you have multiple children, you tend to look around and say, well, Johnny didn't fall
right.
to this, and Sally's okay. What did I do to Mandy?
Mm-hmm.
There must be something I did. And what you're saying is, no, it's not so much like that.
Right.
The bottom line is the illness, the underlying illness is one you either have or you don't. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So you go through high school and you're paying an increasingly heavy toll of consequences for using, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Through high school, I spent my entire high school career drinking, partying, using whatever drug I could find, skipping class, skipping school, leaving early, detentions. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just red flags everywhere. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was normal. Mm-hmm. I thought I was okay. My parents were divorced at this time. My mother was upset, depressed about the situation. And it was just her trying to raise two teenagers, which I'm sure is not easy. And me being the rebellious one, I was not easy.
Right.
And I was just trying to find myself. As I got older, things got worse. At the beginning of my senior year, I was drinking in the mornings. I was drinking at school. I'd bring a water bottle of vodka with me to school. I was using drugs in the bathrooms, under the stairwells, whatever I could find. And I was asked to leave. Beginning of my senior year, probably halfway through my senior year, I was asked to leave and I was sent to detox.
And I think that's a really important moment that we both identified. There was an opportunity for a school counselor or mm-hmm. or someone to identify you as someone with the disease of substance use disorder. That was a clear opportunity right. that was missed. But the fact of the matter is you were.
Right.
And that kind of sets you or reignites the path for you. It does
exactly.
the opposite of what the intended effect might have been, right?
The complete opposite, because then at that point, so I'm in detox, I'm 17, I'm scared, I'm alone, I'm confused. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm not realizing what's going on inside my head. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of these, you know, all these feelings that I'm having are so strong and so intense and I can't control them. The only way that I knew how to control any of this was by drinking or using some sort of drug. So I'm in detox. I get out. I'm again moved to a new school. I moved in with my dad and I did, you know, while I was adjusting, I stayed sober, but I eventually, after a month or so, had a little group of friends and I went out. And my first night out, I'm drinking and I'm using cocaine and whatever else I can find. And, you know, it's the first time out. My dad lets me use his car and I'm driving under the influence. I mean, that's just how scary it is.
Right.
I'm 17 and right. I've got no clue how wrong this is.
And you've got, but it is wrong, but by the same token, you have an untreated illness.
Yes.
So if you were a diabetic and you said, well, I managed to avoid the chocolate cake for a couple months, this and that, you're still not treated. The next time right. you have a piece of chocolate cake, off to the races you go, bang, you go down, you're in a coma, so on and so forth. So
exactly.
You have an untreated mental illness, which, if left untreated, is guaranteed to result in disability and or death.
Correct. There's
no happy outcomes from this. So here you go down this road again, and your addiction takes kind of a continues to develop momentum,
progress.
Right? Progress,
yes, exactly.
Right? Exactly. At that time, have your parents understood that you have substance
no.
use disorder?
No, I don't think that they. I mean, they'd tell me, you know, you're wild, you're crazy, calm down, you're going to get in trouble. I mean, they tried, but there's only so much that they can do, and I. At least at the time, I thought I was good at what I was doing.
Right.
I was a liar. I was a cheater. I was a manipulator. I convinced everybody that, you know, I had an excuse for everything or blamed everybody else for anything that went wrong or anything that happened or if I got in trouble or got caught or crashed my car or, you know, it was I hit a mailbox one day and the mailbox shouldn't have been there. Like, everything was everybody else's fault.
Right.
And like I said, my mom was depressed and alone, and she did as best as she could to deal with it. But when you're sick, like, you know, I was going to do whatever I had to do to get what I needed and wanted.
Which is the definition of substance use disorder, which
exactly.
is the obsession.
It's a mental obsession.
It's a mental obsession, which to somebody that doesn't have it, Mandy, and how many times have you heard this? Why don't they just stop? Right?
Exactly.
Right? It's like asking somebody to heal themselves of any other illness. You can't do it.
Just stop.
Yeah.
It will drive you insane, mm-hmm. and it's a mental as well as a mental obsession. There is a physical dependency on these substances, and you remove your drug of choice, and you're sick. Mm-hmm. You are very sick, and you'll do whatever you have to do to get what you need to feel better,
mm-hmm.
and you can't just stop.
No. I just want to take a minute to remind everybody, we're speaking with Mandy Lerner. Mandy Lerner is a courageous young woman who is a woman living in recovery. We are collaborating with the SAFE Coalition to celebrate National Recovery Month, which is the month of September. My name's Jim Derrick. This is Chapters Radio. You can find my podcast at www.chaptersradio.com. So, Mandy, picking back up on the story, you're now an older teenager. This addiction has really manifested itself. You paid some consequences, but you still don't identify as an addict or an alcoholic. And importantly, those around you don't yet.
Right. No.
And so what happens next?
I graduate high school.
Yep.
After having to do an extra year from transferring. I graduate and I have the brilliant idea to get an apartment and move to Providence, which was disastrous.
Right.
It was just an excuse and an opportunity to drink and use more. Mm-hmm. I had zero supervision. I was on my own schedule. And as long as I went to work, which I was a waitress during the day, and I worked at a nightclub at night, which is like the worst environment for someone like me.
Right.
So I'm drinking day and night. I'm using day and night. And that apartment is very short lived. I was evicted within months and back home with my dad, with my head, you know, just head down, embarrassed, ashamed. Yeah. And, you know, at that point, it just continued for years, drinking every night, using whatever I could, until 2012, when I had surgery on my neck. The surgery went wrong, and I was overprescribed Percocets for a couple of months. I was prescribed.
So these are painkillers. Percocet, for people that don't know, are basically synthetic heroin.
Right. So this went
on. So here now, someone with substance use disorder gets the key to the kingdom, which is Percocet.
This just set me off. I mean, this definitely wasn't the start of my addiction and my problems, but this was kind of the icing on the cake. This is where things really took a turn, because I had used opioids throughout high school, dabbled into whatever I could, really. But this is when, you know, I was prescribed daily. I was eating them all day long.
Right.
This was a 3-month span that I was heavily prescribed until I had a second surgery. Then I was prescribed again by the second doctor. So here I am, prescribed opioids for months. Probably 5 months total, and then I'm cut off.
And now you're physically dependent on opioids.
100%.
When you stop cold turkey, boy, it is an illness like nothing else. Not to mention the mental obsession, which is part of your underlying.
That's all you think about. Mm-hmm. And it's all, and it's such a sickness and it's such a mind game that you literally convince yourself that you are so much worse than you are, too. Mm-hmm. So you're sick, absolutely. But you've convinced yourself that you're dying. This is the end. You're going to die if you don't get what you need. So my use of pills was short-lived, and I quickly went to heroin.
And for anybody that doesn't know, again, we're talking about synthetic heroin. These are the pain pillars that you've heard that Purdue Pharmaceutical manufactured OxyContin. It's that whole class. Heroin is the cheap alternative so that you're not sick. And at this point, you're not getting high. You're just not sick, right?
Exactly. I mean, the high doesn't last long.
Mm-hmm. You hear a lot of addicts talk about chasing that first experience.
High.
Yeah.
You'll never get that first experience, but you will try.
Right.
You will continue to try. And that's what the scary part is. And when you're this sick and you're this far into your drug use, you don't worry about the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
You're just in your head. You want that feeling back, and you'll do what you can to get it. But you're just constantly chasing that high. And for me, you know, I was using heroin for quite a few years. The last few years were just maintaining, just using so that I wasn't sick, so that I could go to work, so that I could be a mom, so that I could clean my house, just so I could get out of bed.
It's and along the way, you just alluded to that, you had two children.
I did.
Happily.
Yes.
And a boy and a girl. But you're really, really sick. And so their mom is extremely sick.
Mm-hmm.
You've got brand new kids. It's hard enough being a parent and a new mom. But to cope with the emotional roller coaster you must have been on must have been mind-numbing.
It's exactly what it is. It's an emotional roller coaster. It's a battle with yourself. I mean, I was constantly torn between, you know, how could you do this? You're a terrible person. You know, the self, you know, I would just talk down to myself. And then 2 seconds later, I'm on the road to go meet my dealer because I need what I need in order to take care of these children. And it's such a lonely and sad and scary life to live.
You know, if you told your story to anybody, Mandy, I can only imagine the fear in doing that, because you talk about the ultimate stigma, right?
Yeah.
The ultimate shame process. It's a new mom or a mom that's using drugs with children present. I mean, you can't, you know, and this, but this is somebody who had a mental obsession and a substance use disorder and illness that it runs so deep that it was developed in your, when you were a little kid,
right?
Really, when you were born, there was no way that you could simply stop.
No.
So you are isolated, really, right? You must have felt totally alone.
Oh,
you just said that.
Mm-hmm.
Totally alone. And this is where stigma comes in. This is what we're trying to do as part of Recovery Month, is to start tamping down this stigma. There's been a lot of work done on it, happily, and a lot of people are getting help as a result. It is important when you're an addict that there be no stigma and shame, or that it be reduced, right? People be talking about it.
I think
How does that play into your psyche? How does it help?
For me, I was very ashamed, very embarrassed, very, you know, full of self-pity, full of fear. I was afraid to ask for help. I'm a mom. I can't, you know, I tried to live this life where everything looked good on the outside, but and I thought nobody knew what was going on, but it was obviously very clear what was going on. I think if I hadn't been so ashamed to ask for help, I would have asked for help a lot sooner.
That's so important to hear.
It's scary to ask for help, especially to ask for help with something that is so stigmatized. You know, it's here I am, a young mother, already embarrassed and ashamed for what I'm doing, never mind to come out and say, this is what I'm doing, I need help. It's
right.
Like the scariest thing. Yeah. Like, everyone's going to judge me. Everyone's going to think I'm, you know, I'm such a bad person.
And you get, there's a lot of markers along the way that reinforce those thoughts that you're a bad person, because in comes DCF, right? Which, they were doing their job. They should have been there.
Right.
Your illness is telling you, there's nothing wrong with me. What are you doing here, right?
Right.
So DCF takes the children.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize, oh my God, I've got to get help, right?
That was my moment. I had been in and out of a handful of detoxes back to back to back, and just wasn't getting it. I wasn't, I don't want to say I didn't want it bad enough, because I did want it. I wanted out of that life. I just didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know what the symptoms of my disease were. I didn't know that what I had, that it was okay that I was who I was. I just needed to work on the problems that I was having in my head. And, you know, once, it's so bad. So when I was in detox, I used to think there was all these people that had DCF in their lives. And I was like, how can these people have DCF in their lives? I mean, like, why? What are they doing? You know, I use, and then I take care of my kids. I don't use around them. What are they doing that's getting them into trouble? And then the next thing I know, there were, when I was Section 35, and there were allegations made that I was driving under the influence with my kids. And that is how DCF became involved. But even still, I didn't think it was an issue. I thought I would, you know, I'll close the case, I'll beat it. They won't keep the case open. I've got this, you know, thinking that I would lie my way out of it, work my way out of it. And when I was away, the last time I was away, a caseworker came to visit me, and that's when it really hit me. And, you know, I was going to lose my kids if I didn't do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is what changed everything, because I never thought it would come down to that. I never thought I could almost lose my kids.
Yeah, and now you're in a really dark, dark spot.
Very.
And you have really a choice to make, right?
Right.
And we just got done saying this isn't a choice, and it's not a choice.
No.
You were sick, but you knew that there was an opportunity for treatment.
You have the choice to recover.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
That is the choice. But
yeah. I want to just remind everybody, we're speaking with the courageous Mandy Lerner, and I call her courageous because this is, September is National Recovery Month. Mandy is a woman living in long-term recovery from substance use disorder, and is courageous enough to come forward and share her story in the hopes that someone else out there might hear it, find hope, find through her experience and her strength, find hope and maybe find the courage to ask for help for the first time, or maybe the second time, because it can take multiple times, right, Mandy? My name's Jim Derrick. This is Chapters Radio. You can find me on my podcast, ChaptersRadio.com. And we are working today in collaboration with the SAFE Coalition to bring this story to people. Mandy, one of the signposts along the way involved the SAFE Coalition, and in particular involved the Franklin Police Department.
Yes.
Can you describe what happened when you had an interaction with the Franklin Police and how that impacted you?
Yes. So my situation with the police department is kind of where my journey to recovery began. I was caught in a sting that I was unaware of. There were two undercover detectives at the same parking lot where I was trying to purchase my drugs. I got into their vehicle thinking that they were my drug dealer. Mm-hmm. They were not. I got out of the car and they came over and they came up to me, and instead of arresting me or getting me into any sort of trouble or, you know, hurting me in any other way, they offered to get me help. They gave me the option to get help. And they contacted the SAFE Coalition for me, who got me a bed in detox.
Right. And that was actually one of two times that you reached out to SAFE, the SAFE Coalition. And, you know, I was saying to you beforehand, the important thing isn't that the resource, the important thing is that the resource was there. Where the rubber met the road is you were willing and strong enough to reach out for that resource.
Right.
I don't want to gloss over the fact, though, and you can't underestimate and you can't overestimate how important it was for the Franklin Police Department to be ready, willing, and able to see treatment as the first line defense.
Right.
And arrest.
It could have gone completely differently.
Right, right. So what you found was a compassionate detectives, compassionate detectives who were willing to not only make the resource available, but make the call.
Right. They did it for me. Yeah.
Right.
They made the call. There was a bed.
Yep. And that to me is where the rubber meets the road for coalition building and conversations, because this is the result when we have a person sitting in front of me today, clean and sober, with one day at a time, with their illness in check, happily with the children in their lives, the beautiful children in their lives. And the fact of the matter is, as Mandy just said, it could have gone one of two ways. And one of those ways wasn't good if we didn't have a police department that was willing to interact with local resources to help get you help. Mandy, you have a great life today.
I do.
Don't you? Tell us a little bit about that. How has life changed? I mean, we don't have 3 hours that we need.
You know, it's just crazy. And even, you know, every now and then I think back, you know, if I'm having a tough day, because they happen, you know.
Sure.
For me, reflecting is huge. You know, I like to look back at where I was, you know, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, where I, you know, walking around town to get to where I needed to go. Since I've been sober, I have a home. I have my kids every single day. They are with me. You know, I have custody of them. I have a full-time job with pretty insane responsibilities. I have everything that I've lost plus more. And I have a spiritual life, which I did not have at any time in my life, whether I was using or not. I've never been spiritual. And through recovery, I've become spiritual, which is one of the biggest things for me.
And you could probably tell by my reaction how powerful your story is, how powerful the story of hope is to people like myself that see the other side of this, you know, and you've seen it too.
Yes.
You've seen more than your share of devastation. So I didn't mean to say that, you know, I was the only one in the room that understood that, but it's such a powerful thing to have somebody like you stand up and say, I'm willing to be counted. This happened to me. I'm not going to have any, I'll tell you my story. The really incredible part of the story is, and we were talking about this before when we did our television show, when you're sitting alone in your second or third treatment center, maybe it was when you're sectioned, and you realize you're losing your children, and you literally have a come to Jesus, and you say, I've got a this is me. I don't have anything left.
Right.
You've lost your car. You've lost your job.
Everything and
you've
everyone.
Stolen from your family. You burned your relationships. And now it's you alone. And I don't think I can even appreciate how dramatic and traumatic that must have been.
That time in my life is something, you know, I'll never forget that feeling, that oh my God moment, that God moment, that moment where I made the decision to make the change. And unfortunately, that's what it took for me, almost losing my kids. I didn't care about everything else that I had lost. I had nothing. I had no one. My family was done. My friends, I didn't have friends, you know. And all I had was my kids, and I was going to lose them. And that, to me, was where I decided that I was going to make the change, and I was going to get well. And I was going to do whatever it took to get well. And like I was telling you earlier, you know, I spent May, June, and July walking around town to get to, you know, my meetings and my support groups and women's groups and grocery shopping and anywhere I needed to go. I was walking. I had a backpack, and that's all I owned, what was in that backpack. But, you know, eventually I got a car and a get well job and
in a house now.
A house now,
with
you know,
the kids.
With the kids. Yeah. Now I have everything I need, you know, and, you know, material things, it is what it is. But I have peace of mind today, and I have a spiritual life and my kids.
Annie, I'll tell you another thing. You have a beautiful smile.
And thank you.
I got to tell you, you light up a room. I am so honored to call you a friend. I am so thankful of you sharing this story. And I know for people out there that are listening, that if you have experience with substance use disorder, either yourself, in your family, and you think that there's no more hope, I want you to know that I'm sitting across from somebody who might have thought their situation hopeless at one time.
Absolutely.
And it was nothing.
There's always hope.
There's
as
always
long
hope.
As you're still breathing, there's hope.
Right.
And there were so many times that I could have, you know, I could have died. There were so many times that I am lucky to have woken up. Mm. And, you know, as long as you're alive, there's hope.
And it's really, I mean, and people might see that as cliche sometimes.
Exactly.
We're sitting around the support group
so
halls
true.
And people, it's so dark, you know.
Yeah.
But had you lost hope that day,
yeah.
If you had lost hope on that day that DCF had your kids and you just said, yeah, I'm just going to give in, the story would be much different. But you had the will to change things.
There's such an inner, you know, I was constantly going back and forth with myself. And at that moment, I truly weighed out my options. I, you know, it can't get any worse, so why not just continue the way I am?
Right.
Or make it better.
Right.
And I made the choice to make it better.
I can tell you right now that your kids are lucky to have the mom that's sitting across from me right now.
Thank you.
They're lucky because you are bringing to them the experience of those years of pain, the courage to understand what was going on inside of yourself, the courage to understand what you could change. Right, I'm about to do the
serenity prayer.
Let me restart that. But your kids are looking at a mom who has provided the best example that they will ever get of how to be a strong human being, and importantly, what resilience is, and the importance of developing resilience and emotional intelligence over their lifetime. Now, I've met them both. They're not able to articulate this right now, as cute as they are and as smart as they are.
Right.
But they're really young. They're toddlers. But really, what a gift to your children. And I include all the years of heartache that you had to endure, because they have a role model to look at. They have a guide, because they will definitely have problems in life, right? I mean, as long as you're living, you're going to have problems.
Right.
The question is, what are you going to do with those problems? Mm-hmm. And you face the darkest days that anybody can imagine, and look at you now. And that's what the kids have. So, you know, Mandy, I can't thank you enough for doing this. I want to remind people that if they do find themselves needing help, please reach out to the SAFE Coalition at 508-488-8105. You can walk right into your police department and ask for help. You can walk into, maybe not so obviously, I shouldn't say that, but You can walk into town hall, you can walk in anywhere and ask for help. The great thing about our environment now is that it has changed. We're not done, but it has changed. And people do understand that this is an illness, not a choice. There is no shame in asking for help. The only shame is being silent and suffering silent. That's a shame because people should never be allowed to sit with this any illness, particularly an illness like substance use disorder that has been so stigmatized over the years. They should never sit alone and suffer in silence. So I want to thank you again, Mandy, for being here. My name's Jim Derrick. And coming up next, we're joined in studio by Taylor Weaver for our next recovery story. In studio right now, I have with me Taylor Weaver. Welcome, Taylor.
Hi.
It's great to see you. Taylor is going to share her story of recovery. Just to remind everybody, we are partnering with the Safe Coalition this month and featuring recovery stories for the month of September, which is National Recovery Month. And we often hear the tragedy that goes along with substance use disorder, this illness, addiction, alcoholism. Very rarely do we take a moment to pause and celebrate recovery. And that's why I'm so glad you're here, Taylor. So welcome once again. Taylor, can you tell us a little bit about your early years growing up and when you first realized that you had it first became obvious to you that you had a problem with alcohol and or drugs?
Well, I grew up in Franklin after moving from Norfolk, Mass, where I went to King Philip for a few years. And then I eventually switched to Franklin High School, mm-hmm. Where I played hockey, softball, and club hockey outside. The move was a lot. I had a lot of pressure on me as an athlete and a student. And a lot of the athletes drank, especially the hockey team, after pasta parties. And I fell into drinking, essentially.
And don't you think some of the stereotype, you hear a lot of parents say, oh, well, my son or daughter are athletes. They're fine. I guess that didn't hold true for you, right?
I'm not going to lie. The hockey parties were some of the best times in high school.
Really?
Everyone had fun, but some people could keep the drinking to the minimum and mm-hmm. have the fun. But when I went home, it wasn't fun anymore. Mm-hmm. So,
what type of a drinker were you at that time?
I was a social drinker, but I realized now that even back then I had a drink to get drunk. I never had one or two at 16 years old. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Wow. I hit it full force.
Yep. Yep. So that you're going through high school and you're actually bringing alcohol to school?
Yeah. So my dad had a full bar in the basement and I used to fill up Poland Spring water bottles, vodka, the old tricks, and teachers never said anything. I think a lot of teachers thought it was protein drinks or whatever I had from sports because I'd play hockey across the street at the rink before and walk over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They never would have thought at 7:30 in the morning that's what someone's doing. So
sure. How were you feeling emotionally at this time?
I had a lot of anxiety, depression, and pressure at home from school and sports. Most of it was depression. I think the anxiety was just more like the anxious social of moving mm-hmm. and new people. But a lot of it was depression from just change and drinking like that, too, is not going to make you happy. So
were you paying any major consequences for your drinking?
No, I was not. I didn't pay any major consequences until junior year, but it wasn't even for drinking. I acted out on behavior that was caused from drinking.
Yeah.
So I had a lash out, and then I was essentially walked out of school during finals, and then I still got a D1 offer to go play hockey at a boarding school to finish off my 2 years, so I still never hit a consequence.
No, so did that kind of act as proof for you that, hey, I don't have a problem?
Yeah.
I mean, if I can get a Division I scholarship for women's hockey as an athlete, what kind of problem could I possibly have?
No, everyone else was the problem. The school was the problem.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there you go. Right, right, right.
The teacher that called my parents that day was the problem. I didn't do anything wrong. I'm an A's and B's student with the world in front of me, so
that makes sense. So you go off to college as an athlete now, Division I goalie, right?
Yeah. No, actually D3, but I played D1 in boarding school.
Oh, I'm sorry, D1. Yeah. That's right. So you're going away now for high school for Division I high school hockey, which is a big deal. And you go to a boarding school, and what's different about the boarding school?
The wealthy kids
yeah.
have access to all sorts of fun stuff. Well, what I thought was fun. They, a lot of them were on Adderall. A lot of them were on benzos. I had never robo-tripped before. I learned to drink. I shouldn't say learned, but I had someone tell me to essentially drink cough medicine to get banged up, and I did it. And it
so
was,
that's Robitussin cough yeah. medicine with codeine in it, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
That was different. Yeah. I found out now that a lot of people do that. But
yeah, I do hear it a lot. And so, again, it's just another way for you to medicate, right?
Yeah, so you know, I self-medicated this entire time. I was still depressed away at school. Yeah. I never spoke up about it.
Mm, that's interesting. And did you see it as self-medication, or did you just justify it as partying? I'm just like everybody else.
I justify it as partying. I mean, I had people say stuff to me, but I was like, yeah, what you say doesn't matter. I had the ego going on.
Mm-hmm. How about escalation? Was it an escalating problem? Was it something you had to continue to escalate every time you went out, or not every time, but did you feel like it was ramping up, or was it?
It definitely ramped up because I was never like a marijuana smoker. So I went from drinking to Robitussin to going home from school, from boarding school to come home. I'd visit and I took pills out of the cabinet and then I brought them back to the school and would eat them. And then eventually it turned into getting painkillers. So it escalated, but I saw it as makes me all feel the same.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and so, yeah, right, exactly. It's making you all feel the same. But the fact of the matter is the nature of the substance is upping the ante here, because now you're playing Russian roulette. Not that alcohol is not dangerous, but you're playing Russian roulette with a variety of medications, including prescription opioids, which are synthetic heroin.
Oh, yeah. And right? then that I started out snorting mm-hmm. when I went to my D3 mm-hmm. college to play hockey.
Mm-hmm.
And that still wasn't a problem to me.
Right. And still no major consequences. And when
no.
I say major, I mean, I'm assuming you woke up hungover, you woke up tired, but...
Oh, yeah.
No trouble with the law, no trouble with getting...
No, I never been arrested. I got drinking tickets in college, but everyone did. If you walked to and from campus and were drinking, they were like, here's a ticket. And I was like, okay, here's $100. Like,
sure.
No, everyone got them.
Right. And you've got two parents, two loving parents at home.
Yep.
You've got a brother, you've got family.
Yeah.
And so now you're up at college, and what happens up at college that changes things for you?
I was very away. Like, I was 4 hours versus an hour and a half in
right.
the boarding school, so I learned I didn't need to go home. I met new people. I found new drugs. I sat in my room and started snorting medication, painkillers, to the point where I wasn't going to class anymore. I went from above a 3.0 student in high school down to below like a 1.5. And then I got kicked off the hockey team. So
right.
I still didn't think I had an issue. And I had people say stuff. They were like, are you going to get out of bed? Are you going to come to class? I had people come in my room like pretending to take like a pill just so I wouldn't do like 5.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, to anybody that doesn't have substance use disorder, the disease of addiction, that sounds like a crazy story. Taylor, just stop. But that's not something you have the option of, right?
No.
It's a mental obsession, right?
Oh, yeah. I liked being numb. I liked not... Like, I could just go through my day like, nothing's going to bother me today.
Right. And so far, the only consequence you've paid is basically, at this point, now you're getting dismissed from college. But is that a big deal to you right then,
no.
relative to drugs?
No, I was like, there's community colleges, all this stuff. I didn't care.
Yeah. Yeah, but probably in your mind, it was the college's fault anyway.
Yeah, no. Yeah, no, it's funny. It's funny to look back at now how naive, I guess, I was.
Yeah.
But.
Well, I've heard people say this is the disease that continually tells you that you don't have a sickness.
Oh, yeah.
That you're fine.
100%. I still have those days, too, so not that I mean, being sober, I have the days where I think I'm... Yeah. Oh, yeah, I can go do that. And then I'm like, I got to talk myself off the ledge.
Yep. I want to remind everybody, we're speaking with Taylor Weaver. Taylor is a young woman living in long-term recovery from substance use disorder, which sadly has become our nation's number one health epidemic. My name's Jim Derrick. This is Chapters Radio. You can find me at my podcast, chaptersradio.com. And this month is National Recovery Month. We're partnering with the SAFE Coalition, bringing you recovery stories. And I'm really grateful that Taylor's here. Taylor has just been dismissed from her college where she was playing girls hockey at a very, very high level. And no pun intended, Taylor. But seriously, she was playing hockey. I'm sure it was a dream of yours at one time, right?
Oh, yeah.
Play collegiate hockey?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Well, I grew up figure skating, so my brother played hockey. I was jealous, so yeah. I got out there.
So it's even more of a dream because you got your brother jealous of you. So you come back home to Franklin at that point?
Yeah, I came back home for the summer and what I thought was the summer of my life. Party, drank. Use drugs, and then I decided I'm gonna go join the army.
Uh-huh. Which... So you enlisted in the army?
I did. I enlisted, and got in, and I left that August, the end of August. My first day was actually September 11th of basic training.
Wow.
So.
Wow.
That was.
Yeah, quite a day to start.
And so
you get to basic training, and you have a hard lesson to learn, right, about what's been going on to your body?
Yeah, so...
Did you identify as an alcoholic and addict then?
No, I still thought I was this normal partier.
Okay.
And I hung around with people doing the same stuff, but honestly, it's sad. Most of those people are gone now, so I see it now as not normal. But I went to the Army, and that was a detox I had learned later in life. I had gotten sick. I was running. I would get actually vomit from... working out, and I was like, oh, what the heck's going on? Like, I played sports my whole life. I'm in shape, but it was my body just hating my body. It was reacting, and I was shaking and stuff, and then I went through basic all fine, but I still had, like, it was crazy. I mean, I still thought about it there the whole time. I was like, I can't wait to get home and have a drink.
Yeah, the obsession.
Yeah, I still thought about it.
Yeah.
I got jealous of those drill sergeants, too. I was like, they get to go home and, like, do whatever they want.
Have a cocktail. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you're thinking about it. And then this is the part I don't think the average person can understand. I know it's hard for me because I can put down I'll socially drink, and I can put down a drink and not even think about it.
Yeah.
For a long, long, long time. But for you, it's different, right?
Yeah, I look back on it now. I never... drank not to get drunk.
Right.
I never was like, oh yeah, let's go meet for a beer. I was like, let's go meet for 10. Like, let's have shots. Like, there was no, I was not level-headed. There was nothing normal about it.
Yep. So after you come out of the Army, what happens?
I come out of the Army. I came home. I went down the worst path. I mean, all of it's a pretty bad path, but I came home. I started drinking more. I had access to benzos. I had access to opiates. I would mix them. I'd self-medicated. I didn't want to, like, identify with my depression, I guess I would say. Mm-hmm. I sat there and destroyed probably, like, 90% of friendships and relationships in my life. Blacked out pretty much every time I had used. I crashed my car, lied to my family that I had hit ice. I did get away with that. I mean, I drove my car off of the road and off of Route 1 near the Gillette Stadium, and I had turned the keys and the ignition off, threw them, and the cop had said, did you drive? I said, no, I lied. And the cop looked at me like, oh, like, this isn't, like, you're lying, but I'm going to drive you home. And I'm lucky I'm alive, but I also was kind of unlucky I didn't get arrested. I think that might have been my turnaround, but I got away with that DUI. I didn't get charged or anything. He just took me back to my apartment. And I still thought I was invincible, thought the whole thing was funny. Mm-hmm. And then it didn't get funny in July when it got so bad that I got developed suicidal thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to be here anymore. Mm-hmm. And I self-medicated in my apartment for just about 3 days, isolated, kept to myself, had friends messaging my parents through social media so they didn't know how to stay in contact, and I was like, why are my parents calling me? Like, that wasn't a thing. Like, no one. I was on my own for all these years. And then I eventually sat there and had 10 to 15 ways probably in my head how to not be here anymore. And I was like, I don't want to feel this way. And I had checked myself in to get help.
So that was your, what we will call rock bottom for you.
Yeah, right. I definitely would say I didn't have those signs for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's so interesting to me, Taylor, and thank you for this story. It really is raw and, as people can hear, transparent. And that's another thing I love about recovery.
Yeah.
Is you become quite honest, don't you?
Yeah, you do. You get honest pretty quick, actually.
Yeah. Because so much of your life has been lived in addiction, has you living in deceit.
I mean, very
little truth telling.
Yeah, you, very little.
Right.
And even half truths are lies, so.
Right, right.
And saying you're okay is a lie, so.
Yeah, exactly, right. So, but, you know, here the disease of substance use disorder has been classified, first of all, as just that, a disease. Second of all, it has been classified as a mental health illness, a mental illness, which is important to me because so many of the stories start with depression and anxiety and mental health symptoms. And yours is laced with that all the way through there.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Who wouldn't want to self-medicate?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, but happily, we are here to tell the rest of the story, which is that wonderful moment. That was July 7th.
July 7th, my recovery date. So I have just over 2 years, but I am... checked myself in, went to detox, got some help, felt the worst I'd ever felt, I would say, finally feeling things. And I had the shakes. I didn't eat for a few months, but I will say I'd rather never feel that way again, so I'll never go back.
Yeah, and you know what? But not only that, but you get through the physical part of it. You had an important message that you shared with me off the air, and that was that feeling that in early recovery that, man, maybe I'm stuck. Maybe this isn't so much fun. Maybe I should just go back to my old ways. And you had a message about that.
Yeah, so I always use that for 6 months as like a life lesson for anyone.
Right.
I don't give up on myself now. I mean, I look at that time period as like the worst. Yeah, detox was terrible, but I could go back and I could sit there and give up on myself. But you're going to hit a struggle. You're going to hit roadblocks. You're even while clean and sober. So you gotta keep it moving, keep going, and not give up on yourself. And I mean, I sat there those first 6 months. I was like, this is not fun.
Right.
But life's not always gonna be fun. But it gets fun in recovery eventually. Like you gotta stick and stay with it. I mean, I still have my days, and then I look at those 6 months when I started in recovery, and I'm like, man, like. No, I'm not going back.
Yeah, and
it's scary because you finally have to deal with yourself. In those first 6 months, a lot of people approach you and they talk to you, and you're like, you're white knuckling it. Like I sat there and was like, I don't want to talk to you about this, and like,
right.
You got to deal with yourself finally, and like, you got to deal with yourself, the damage you've done, and don't give up through
with a clear
it.
Mind.
Yeah, don't give up through it, and that's like anything in life. You could have a rough 6 months with anything, addiction. Eating disorder, anything. You just keep going. Because what's the point? You're already feeling your worst. What worst can happen? It's only going to go up.
And once you put down the drug and the alcohol, really, isn't recovery mostly about how to live your life and how to get through problems and develop resilience into what you're talking about?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Right?
Yeah, it's you learn new ways to think and new ways to handle, like, real-life problems.
Yeah.
Not just, I'm going to go to the bar today on that one, but...
Yeah.
You sit there and you deal with it. Like.
And we're on radio right now, but I'm sitting about 6 feet away from Taylor, and her smile's infectious. Her eyes are alive. It's really great being around people in long-term recovery because of the joy for living and the excitement about being alive, you know? And Taylor, I have to say, I mean, the courage it takes to be in that dark spot and not to give up on yourself when so many others have given up on you is a thing that really moves me every time I hear the story. There seems to be that moment with people in long-term recovery where they can remember, like it was yesterday, I'm not going to give up on myself, even when everybody else has given up on me.
Right? Yep.
And one of your messages I know earlier was just for us not to give up on people that we know that are addicts, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. Being in recovery because I still have friends who are actively using, but I always say love someone from a distance because they can still come to you. Don't cut them off. They're still a human being. I had a lot of people cut me off. That's what made those first 6 months hard because I still felt kind of like useless in my skin.
Mm-hmm.
But then I eventually felt that's like I'm the problem. They didn't do anything.
Right.
So, but you don't give up on those people. There's still someone in there you love deep down. Like.
Yeah.
And I always look at myself that way because it's tough. Like a lot of addicts, even in recovery, we still don't like parts of ourselves. We're still picky.
I almost want to say welcome to the human race, but that's what you said earlier, right? Because all of us don't like parts of ourselves.
Yeah, we
but
all
I think
don't.
It's magnified because you've been numb for a long time.
Oh, yeah. So for all those years, you just new things come into your head. Yeah. It's wild though, but I always tell people, like, everyone's going to have a problem. Would you want them to walk away from you?
Yeah. And Taylor, you shared with us, you talked about the joy of recovery and some of the really great things that you've tried since being in recovery.
Oh, yeah. So I did yoga, which I never thought I'd do. I went and bought a kayak my first, like, 8 months in. Mm-hmm. Got myself back into skating a little bit. And then I do boxing. So just a bunch of new stuff. And I just threw myself out there.
You got a beautiful little girl.
Yeah, I got a 4-year-old daughter. So
congratulations.
Thank you. She's awesome. Yeah. So we do a lot together now. Not hungover. So
you love life.
Yeah, no, I do. I love it. It's
and
fun.
There's a social life, right? You've got friends in recovery.
Oh yeah, and like all my friends and like their parents now make fun of me. They're always like, "Do you ever sit still now?" I'm like, "No, there's so much to do."
That's great. And in addition to that, you found. I know that you said that you can socialize and hang out with your friends that are still social drinkers, that it's not, you've gotten to a point where...
Yeah, I've gotten to a point to accept that people around me are still going to drink. Mm-hmm. I understand, like, drug use is not, like, I understand there's a normal side to it and there's not. I can go to a bar now and sit there. I don't suggest anyone to do that who's in early recovery or anyone in recovery do that if they're not comfortable. But my friends all accept me for who I am.
Sure.
And they're the ones that... Oh, if I'm out, I'm like, I'm going to leave by 10:30.
Yep.
And I don't judge them. They don't judge me.
Yep.
But they never, you got to be around the right people, as I say, because they're not the ones that are going to hand me a drink. They know what I've come from. So they respect me. I respect them.
Yeah. Taylor, I can't thank you enough for sharing your message. I know you speak to high school age students. You're very active in the recovery community. I'm very, very thankful for you. And I'm glad that that you didn't give up.
Yeah.
And the message is don't give up. The message is hope alive. That was Taylor Weaver, a woman in long-term recovery from substance use disorder. So I want to thank once again our two guests, Mandy Lerner and Taylor Weaver, both courageous young women who stepped forward to share their stories with the hope that their experience may help others and keep hope alive that recovery is indeed possible and happening every day in our community. So for my guests, Mandy Lerner and Taylor Weaver, my name's Jim Derrick saying thanks for listening to Chapters Radio, and we'll see you next week.